Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay from Chicago, and I am the host for the presentation this morning. Today is Sunday, April 6, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, April 4th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 22,316. That's 22316. For the 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting on Friday, 22,317. That's 22317. This morning, A Vision for You presents Chapter 2. There is a solution. So our speaker's gonna go through all chapter two in the time that we have allotted, right? So we're looking forward to that. In fact, I'm gonna keep it brief, so we can get right into it. But what I will say is, if you hang around the healthy meetings of OA, we learn that what we're seeking is a spiritual awakening as the result of the implementation of the steps. And what that does is, they told me this. I don't know if they were kidding around, but I don't think so. They said, I'm going to be brought into a relationship with power. In fact, it's going to be a power greater than myself. And what recovery enables us to do, among other things, is we develop like an advanced state of spiritual illumination and growth. And it's a beautiful thing. And so every life crisis carries within it the kernels of reversal, you know, renewal, expansion, and a leap in consciousness in a real sense. It's letting go of the old and a rebirth, a birth of the new. And with our higher power, the unresolved seems to get resolved, and our perceptions are no longer colored by fear and indecision, and we no longer have to pay the continuing cost demanded by this disease. We're free. It frees us up, and it frees our consciousness from falsehood. We can see the true from the false, and so the freedom of the bondage of self becomes something much more spiritually tangible. And you know, it's said that most people spend their lives regretting the past and fearing the future. I wasn't able to experience the joy and wonder and awe and mystery in the present, because there was endless intellectualization and endless rumination, much of it done lacking awareness of how we, you know, we construct these elaborate ways of staying stuck. So thank goodness there is a solution. And joining us this morning to share on various aspects of the solution is Janet B. Janet is a recovered compulsive overeater from North Carolina, and she is dedicated to our 12-step way of life, and she's committed to carrying a message of hope to our fellowship. And so it's with great appreciation that we welcome Janet B. to the line this morning. Good morning, Janet. Thank you for doing this service.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, everyone. I'm Janet B., recovered compulsive eater in North Carolina. So if you have your big books, we will start on page 17. There is a solution. Well, if there's a solution, that means first there has to be a problem, right? So I want to know what the problem is. And our book tells us really on page 45 what the problem is. Lack of power. That was our dilemma, lack of power. So they're telling me, I don't have the power I need to stop eating compulsively. And this chapter is going to first tell me what the solution is. But first, they spend a little time talking about what the problem is. So they start out by saying, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They solved the problem. So it seems that there's a nexus, a connection between being hopeless and recovering, right? This program is a lot of work. And I'm not going to do it if I feel I have other options. Who, except a person who believes they have incurable cancer, is going to go through chemotherapy? Oh, is going to go through these 12 steps, which means clearing away the wreckage of our past, making hard amends, deciding to live my life on God's terms and not my term. So we have to feel hopeless. So they spend the beginning of this chapter kind of talking about that and what hopelessness is before they tell us the beautiful solution. And they go on to say, we're just run-of-the-mill people. We're average Americans, and I think beyond Americans. We're average citizens of planet Earth. All sorts of people are represented. And they say, when we recover, we're like people who had undergone shipwreck and are now grateful. I mean, imagine all the people who survived the Titanic. They're all grateful. They've got something in common that binds them. But then they go their own way. They say, not us. We have a powerful cement that binds us. And what is it? A common solution. They're not telling us yet what the common solution is, but they say it works for every one of us, people who normally wouldn't mix, people of different political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. So this works for all of us, even people like me who felt I was different because I was more this or less that. It worked for all of us. And it says we have a way out on which we can absolutely agree. So imagine getting 100 alcoholics to not only agree, but absolutely agree on this solution, but they're not telling us what that solution is yet. So page 18, they talk more about this illness. They say an illness of this sort, and we've come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. So here's the thing about an illness. An illness requires an intervention. About 6 months ago, I had a bout of COVID, and afterwards, I still had trouble breathing for quite a while, and I kept saying, it'll get better, it'll get better. It didn't get better. I needed an outside intervention. I needed to go to the doctor who gave me medicine, which thank God cleared it all up, but I needed that intervention. When I had a bout of pneumonia a number of years ago, I needed penicillin. Illnesses require an outside intervention. And they say, okay, but this illness is different than other illnesses. If someone has something like cancer, everyone feels bad for him. No one's angry at her or hurt, but not with us. Our illness, it talks about annihilates, completely destroys all the things worthwhile in life. And it tells us some of the fruits of this illness: misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, warped lives of our kids. But the illness is the primary thing. These things are all symptoms. And just like I can't treat pneumonia at a symptom level, right? I can't take cough medicine and sneezing medicine. I have to take an antibiotic to clear it up. I can't just sit there and try and resolve resentments, try and resolve my financial insecurity on its own. The illness is primary, so I need to treat this illness at its core. Okay, and then they tell us what they hope this book will do, inform us and comfort us. And they tell us psychiatrists have been largely unsuccessful with us, unfortunately. So have our relatives and close friends. And then the first italic paragraph in this chapter. But the ex-problem drinker or eater who has found this solution, again, they're not telling us what the solution is yet, who understands himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic compulsive eater in a few hours. Well, that says a couple things to me. It says, I need to put in the time. It's not take two food plans and call me in the morning. I need to take time getting to know the person, letting the person get to know me. Put in the time. And it says, until we do that, really nothing can be accomplished. And then they give us 9 things that make up an effective 12-step call if we want to help someone. So they say the first thing, we've had the same difficulty. Well, if I'm talking to a doctor, I may feel ashamed, but if I'm talking to someone who was a compulsive eater but now doesn't binge anymore, I don't feel that kind of shame. It's easier for me. Number 2, that he obviously knows what he is talking about. Y'all, that's why we study this book. We need to understand what this solution is and how we can help people get it. Number three, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer. Now note, it says his deportment shouts. The way he carries himself shouts. We are not supposed to shout at each other. We are not supposed to yell at each other and say, why don't you get this? But we are supposed to just kind of give off a vibe that we understand this because we've been there and we've applied the solution, that they're not telling us what it is yet. They said that he has no holier-than-thou attitude. All I may be is someone who got on the bus a couple stops before the next guy. That's it. Doesn't make me any better. Number five, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful. I'm helpful really for two reasons. One, and this is a more selfish motive, because I know if I'm not, I'm going to end up in the food again. We are required to work with others. And two, this is fun. It is fun to work with another person and see dead eyes come alive, and see people recover and then sponsor other people. Number six, that there are no fees to pay. We never charge a penny for this. Number seven, no axes to grind. We are not anti-sugar, anti-wheat, anti-anything anonymous. We are just people who couldn't eat like in a normal way, and we needed divine help to do so. Number eight, no people to please. That includes our sponsors. It is not my job to please my sponsor. It is my job to tell my sponsor the truth so that she can help me. I believe it is better to be rigorously honest and have no sponsor than to be dishonest and have the best sponsor in the world. We are not in the business of pleasing people. We're in the business of pleasing God. And number nine, no lectures to be endured, which I think is pretty funny as I'm sitting here giving a kind of a lecture for 40 minutes or so. But basically, they're saying we don't ring people out. We don't sit there if someone's having a problem and for 30 minutes tell them how horrible they are. And they say, if we do this, these are the conditions we found most effective. Page 19 says, after such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. Kind of interesting sentence. So that implies like we are really unable to walk. We're unable to, you know, at least walk spiritually. And some of us so ill, we could barely walk physically. But not only do we walk, we can carry our beds. We're strong. This program doesn't just heal us. It like heals us times 100. Okay, page 19, it says, we make a sole vocation of this work, which means we don't quit our jobs and help people 10 hours a day. And they say, we don't think it would be more effective if we did. Then they tell us, we feel elimination of our drinking, of our compulsive eating, is but a beginning. So that doesn't mean that the goal is to just stop binging and then that's it. Like, okay, your food's down, great, now go live a happy life. It also, for me, didn't mean that I had to put down the food in order to start working these steps. I couldn't put down the food. So what does that look like? It looks like right away I had to admit I'm powerless and just work on doing what I thought God, if he really cared about me, would want me to do. And then it tells us a much more important demonstration of our principles. So they're telling me we have principles, lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. A friend of mine once went through the big book and made a list of all the spiritual principles. Just by way of example, here's two on page 125. It says, we think unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences should not be discussed. So that means if my husband and I have an argument and we make up, I don't bring it up in the future. That's a spiritual principle. Another one on that page, we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. Don't gossip, a spiritual principle. A great exercise is to go through this book and list all the spiritual principles. And they say, all of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we're going to describe, helping others. What does that mean, much of our spare time? Well, I think much means a lot. So I personally, I am a bit of a slug. I could spend an entire weekend, and if I didn't have a job, an entire week lying on my couch, reading books, and watching Netflix. Well, if I'm reading as many novels as I want and watching as much Netflix as I want, I am not spending enough time helping others. I need to be spending much of my spare time. So that means I subtract the time I need to work, the time I need to take care of my family, my health, my sleep, and then the time that's left, much of it has to be spent helping others. And if we are new and we can't obviously be sponsoring, taking people through steps, we can still be spending much of our spare time helping others. We can make sandwiches for homeless people. We could go to Target and fold clothes for, you know, half an hour. We can donate blood. We can clean out our closet and bring the clothes to a homeless shelter. Much of our spare time helping others. And at the bottom of the page, they say, again, still not telling us a solution, but now they're telling us some things we have to discuss. Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. And they know that as soon as they say the word religious, people are going to start rolling their eyes. And we say, we're aware that these matters are controversial. We hope to write a book that contains no basis for contention or argument. And then they tell us, most of us sense real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions or attitudes which make us more useful to others. I will tell you that my closest friends in recovery, we have different viewpoints on religion, on politics, on a lot of social things. That's okay. I respect her opinion and she respects mine. And respecting other people's shortcomings. So I can look at it and say, yeah, maybe my husband isn't as, I don't know, talkative as I would want him to. But I am sure that my husband would say, my wife isn't as neat as I would like her to be. And you know what? I don't make a big deal out of it, and neither does he. He's still my Prince Charming, and I'm sure I'm still his, I don't know, Snow White, Cinderella, whatever. Well, not Cinderella, because she was a good cleaner, but I'm still his princess. It doesn't matter. We overlook each other's shortcomings. So it tells us to have tolerance for other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respecting their opinions are things that make us more useful to others. And so my question, top of page 20, is who cares? Who cares if I'm more useful to others? But they tell me why at the top of that page. They say, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers or eaters for us depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So they're telling me that my life depends upon thinking about others constantly. That means a lot. And thinking how I can help meet their needs. Well, how come my life depends upon it? Well, in chapter 5, they tell us what the roots of this illness are. It says the roots of this illness are selfishness and self-centeredness. So if those are my roots, they're telling me I basically need a root transplant. I need to be transplanted into unselfishness and God-centeredness. So I have to kind of water that plant with unselfish good deeds. So how do I do that? My constant thought of others and how I can help meet their needs. How can I do that practically? Well, first, I can think of the others in my life. We can start with our families, where it's often the hardest. And then go to our neighbors, our community, the broad circle. Obviously, think of other fellow compulsive eaters and think, what are their needs and how can I help them? So my daughter is 23 years old. So the way I thought is like, she's going to need help doing her taxes. I can't expect her to do her taxes herself. So I said, Lizzie, send me your tax forms. I'll do your taxes for you. So that's me thinking of others in my family. I sponsor people. I try, you know, when I read that word constant, you know, my conscience flares up and I say, I could do better in that area. But this is what we have to do. And it says our lives depend upon it. So when I'm sponsoring people, one of the things I tell them to do is every single day they have to do an act of self-sacrifice. By definition, self-sacrifice means I'm giving something up in order to help another person. And if it's anonymous, all the better, because we are people who could go out and join Mother Teresa and then post it on Facebook how unselfish we are. So constant thought of others and how we can help meet their needs. And then they tell us, you may have asked yourself, why are we so ill from drinking or from binging? And they're going to get to an answer in that in a couple pages. But then they say, if you are a compulsive eater who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Right? And they say, well, that's the purpose of this book, to answer such questions specifically. So, y'all, I can tell you one thing. If you hear something at a meeting and you're not sure it's right, look it up in this book. Now, obviously, it's one of the other things I tell my sponsees is to make 3 phone calls a day. Obviously, that is not in the book. But the principle of getting involved in a fellowship is. Now, if I told a sponsee, okay, you don't have as much money as you want, go rob the local convenience store. Well, I would expect my sponsee to come back and say, this program demands rigorous honesty, and holding up a convenience store is not honest, and it's certainly not thinking of others. So again, we shouldn't think just because someone says something, it's gospel truth. We need to check it out with what's in this book. And then they go ahead and they talk about the 3 different types of drinkers: moderate drinkers, hard drinkers, and real alcoholics. And notice they don't call them 3 different types of alcoholic, because the first 2 aren't alcoholic. So a moderate drinker or eater can give it up if there's good reason for it. And so I will tell the story of my husband. He says he doesn't remember this, but I do. About 20 years ago, he went to the doctor. The doctor said, you have high blood pressure. You need to lose about 15 pounds. So my husband did. He just like did this crazy thing called going on a diet. He lost all the weight, and for 20 years, he has kept it off. And if we ever like go on a cruise or something and he puts on a few pounds, we come back and he does this other crazy thing called cutting back. And then within a week, he's back to his normal weight, no problem, moderate eater. A hard drinker or a hard eater is different. They say they can impair themselves physically and mentally, and they may even need medical attention or meetings. And I think these are the people I encountered in my early years of OA. There were people who did like rules and tools and lots of structure and lots of support, and they stopped binging. I think a lot of them were hard eaters. Or my friend Elle, her husband saw that every time he had 1 glass of wine, he couldn't stop. So he decided he would never again have even 1 glass of wine. He still hasn't. He had the allergy of the body, but he didn't have the obsession of the mind. So then they talk about the real alcoholic or the real compulsive eater. May start out moderate, may start hard, but at some stage of drinking or eating careers, loses all control once he starts to drink or eat. Well, so then the logical solution can be, well, then just don't eat. Don't take that first compulsive bite. And then it says, here's the fellow has been puzzling you. It's a puzzle why we do that. Bottom of page 21, it says, he has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. Y'all, when I was younger and I first started OA, I thought, I binge because I am miserable. And then one day, I was 17 years old, I was already a full-fledged compulsive eater in Overeaters Anonymous, unable to stop binging. And this college boy invited me to a Beach Boys concert, and I was in seventh heaven. It doesn't get better than that when you're 17. And I went to the mall, and I bought all this junk food, and I binged. I'm like, huh, like, how could this be? I'm really happy. And then I said, I know, I'm binging to sabotage my happiness. And that was wrong. I wasn't binging because I was miserable, and I wasn't binging to sabotage my happiness. It was like, as the doctor's opinion says on Roman numeral 29, XXIX, I binged because I couldn't not binge. I had the phenomenon of craving that started once I took the first compulsive bite. And again, why then would I ever take the first compulsive bite? Couldn't help it, and they'll talk about this. Why did I do this? Page 22 says, why? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? And here's their answer to the question that we all spent thousands of dollars in therapy for. Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. Okay? So a lot of us want to know why. How did this happen? And, you know, I think the reason we want to know is so that we can figure out who to blame, usually our parents. If my parents hadn't been so strict, so lenient, so this, so that, I wouldn't have been a compulsive eater. You know, I grew up in the same family as my sister. She never had a problem with food. We had the same parents, same upbringing. So it tells us we don't know, and it doesn't matter. Because imagine someone who has, you know, cancer trying to figure out, well, how did I get that? Did I get too many x-rays? Was it because I ate inorganic food? No, they just say, give me the solution. What do I need to do now? And so to us. So they're saying, while the alcoholic compulsive eater keeps away from drink, keeps away from the first compulsive bite, he's fine. But as soon as he takes any alcohol, the first compulsive bite, something happens in the bodily and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible to stop. The experience of any compulsive eater, alcoholic, will abundantly confirm this. And then they ask the $64,000 question. They say, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, therefore setting the terrible cycle in motion. So then why does he? Why? It's academic and pointless, my friend L's husband. It is academic and pointless to him to think about what happens to someone who keeps drinking and gets drunk and loses everything. Because he knows he can't have the first drink, so he doesn't. He has the allergy of the body, but not the obsession of the mind. So they go on and tell us, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic, the compulsive eater, centers in his mind rather than his body. So they're saying the allergy is not the main problem. The main problem centers in my mind, right? If I had the allergy and stayed away from whatever I was allergic to, it would be no problem. So the main problem centers in my mind. On page, I think it's 64, it says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So this illness starts in our soul and then centers in our mind, sets up command central in our mind. And because of, you know, just the allergy that whatever we were born with, we acquired, whatever, we end up in the hot mess that we're in. And they tell us again, page 23, in their hearts, they don't know why they do it. We don't know why we kept binging. You know, I had all these excuses. I'm happy. I want to sabotage myself. I'm miserable. But I was really baffled, like it says. And it says there is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. Right? Isn't that the great obsession? First paragraph of the chapter, More About Alcoholism, says the great obsession is that one day he will control and enjoy his drinking. One day I'll be able to control it, control how much I take and enjoy it, eat as much as I want and not feel guilty the next day. Says that's the obsession. Says, but they often suspect they are down for the count. Page 23, very end of it. The tragic truth, and this is tragic, a tragedy, if the man be a real alcoholic, a real compulsive eater, the happy day may not arrive. Okay, this is like telling someone you've got stage 4 cancer, you're thinking you may recover. No, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. Off of page 24, At a certain point of the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. They call this a tragic situation. So they're saying that there is a point in the eating of every compulsive eater, and we don't know where that point is. For me, honestly, I think that point occurred where I crossed that line before I was 4 years old. He passes into a state, right, where the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. So guys, please don't make the mistake that was made with me for my first 6.5 years in OA. I went to meetings. I was handed a food plan. I couldn't stick to it. And people said, "She must not have the desire to stop. You don't really want to stop." And that wasn't true. I wanted to stop more than anything in the world. I didn't have the power to stop. No one would go up to a cancer patient and say, "If your cancer cells are still multiplying, then you must not have the desire to recover from cancer." But people said pretty much the same thing to me. But I don't blame them. That's what they were taught. They didn't know better. My problem wasn't lack of desire or lack of knowledge of a food plan. My problem was lack of power. And then our second italicized paragraphs in this chapter. The fact is, so they're saying this is a fact, most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. We've lost the power of choice with food. It says our so-called willpower, because we really don't have it, becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink, the first compulsive bite. Then says there's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Okay, so they're telling me here that this is kind of weird. My defense against compulsive eating is my memory and the fact that I'm unable to bring certain memories into my consciousness with sufficient force is the crux of my problem. So let's kind of break that down. So let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove, right? So stored in my memory are all these data points telling me touching a hot stove is dangerous. You went to wipe down the stove and you burnt your fingers. You touched a hot stove and you burnt your hand. You touched a hot stove, it wasn't pleasant. So there I am after dinner about to wipe down the stove. My memory scans the data points, tell you know that all those things about how touching a hot stove will burn my hand generates a thought that runs across the bridge to my conscious mind saying, "Danger, stop, hot stoves will burn you." Or another example, I grew up in Florida, you know, like any good Miami girl, worshiping the sun, getting suntans, but a few times not putting on my sunscreen because that wasn't cool. Baby oil was cool. And I got some bad sunburns. So there I go, about to go out in the sun, saying, "I'm not going to put on my sunscreen," and stored in my memory are these data points. You went to the beach without a sunscreen, and you looked like a lobster for a week. You went by the pool without sunscreen, and you were peeling and miserable for 3 days. You went without sunscreen, and you started getting wrinkles, even though you're young. And so there I am, about to go to the beach. I don't need sunscreen. My memory grabs those data points, generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, "Stop, it's dangerous not to put on sunscreen." I put on sunscreen. And then my own personal allergy example, I am very allergic to cats. If I'm near a cat, I'm liable to have an asthma attack. I'm liable to get a sinus infection a few days later. I'm all snotty and my eyes are running and I am a hot mess. So here I am, a friend invites me to her house. She has a cat. I think, "Oh, I'd really love to go to my friend's house." Immediately, my memory scans the data points, generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind. "Stop, danger, cats will give you an asthma attack. You'll get a sinus infection, you'll be sick, don't do it." My memory keeps me in check and I tell my friend, "I'm very sorry, I can't go to your house." So let's talk about how this worked with food. My best example is when I was in college, I used to binge on a lot of things, pretty much anything. I stole food. I stole money for food. Buy a replacement, eat the replacement before I could get it back. And one thing I binged on was this kind of cookie. It came in a box of 20. I would tell myself, I'm just going to have one or two. But we all know how that story ended over and over. So there in my memory are all these data points. You say you're going to have one or two, but you ate the whole box. You said you were just going to have two, and you did have two. You had two boxes. Then you made yourself throw up. You couldn't get out of bed the next day. Multiple examples like that. So there I go, about to go down the street to buy my box of cookies to just have one or two. And my memory scans those data points, generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind where I make my decisions to say, stop, danger. You won't be able to have one or two. You'll make yourself throw up. You'll hate yourself. You won't be able to get out of bed the next day. You're gaining weight. Don't do it. Except unlike with hot stoves, sunscreen, and cats, the bridge was broken. The bridge between my memory of all those horrible consequences of binges and my conscious mind was broken, and I couldn't stop. The thought didn't get across. My memory failed to hold me in check, and I had no defense against the first compulsive bite. I couldn't just tell myself to stay away from certain trigger foods. When it came to food, the connection, the bridge between my memory and my conscious mind where I make my decisions was broken. And once broken, it can never be repaired. I was hopeless. Just like Bill Wilson, when he realized he was hopeless and said on page 8, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. For me, food was my master, and I had a broken bridge. So what do I do? And they tell me, I am hopeless, bottom of page 24. When this sort of thinking, this, you know, thinking where my bridge doesn't work, is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, so someone who has the physical craving portion already, remember, someone could have a physical craving, but if they don't have this sort of thinking, the obsession of the mind, they can just realize it and stop. But if we have both, this is what they tell us. He has probably placed himself beyond human aid, so no one could help me, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. I didn't die, but I was a walking dead person. I didn't care about anyone other than myself. I didn't care what it took to get people to pay attention to me. I mean, I was the insane person who took a razor blade and slashed my lip with it and telling people that I was mugged so I would get attention. Those are the kind of things I did. And it said, these stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions, that means by lots and lots, of alcoholics and compulsive eaters throughout history. And now, finally, once I see I'm hopeless, I have a broken bridge, that bridge can never be repaired, they're going to tell me how to build another bridge, and that's a bridge to God. And they tell me the solution. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. But for the grace of God, I would have been one of those thousands more convincing demonstrations. What is the grace of God? It simply means unmerited favor, God giving me something I don't deserve. Well, how does that work? Is God up there in the heavens flipping a coin? Like, heads I'll listen to Janet's begging prayers to recover, and tails I'll ignore her? No. Look at the next paragraph. There is a solution. Remember the solution, the grace of God. And then they tell us how to access the grace of God. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires, meaning not suggested, not optional. The process requires for its successful consummation. but we saw it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility in life as we'd been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved. I love how they use the passive voice there. I didn't solve my problems. God solved it by his grace, by his unmerited favor. And it tells me once I realize what the solution is, if I really know I'm hopeless, because remember, those are the people who recover, there's nothing left but to pick up the simple tools, kit of spiritual tools, surrender to God, clear away the wreckage of my past, do God's will as best I can, help others, connect with God more. That's what I have to do. And then what's the result? It says, we have found much of heaven and we have been rocketed, again, passive, I've been rocketed, I didn't rocket myself, into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Well, what is this fourth dimension? Bill Wilson described it in Bill's story, page 8. He says, I was soon to be catapulted, another word like rocketed, into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness. Guys, just like the illness has symptoms, so does recovery have symptoms. Happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Recovery is progressive, just like this illness is. And then it says, I think one of the most important paragraphs in the book, page 25, the great fact, so not an opinion, the great fact is just this and nothing less. We should settle for nothing less because ultimately nothing less will give us permanent recovery. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experience. Okay, what is a spiritual experience? It says it's something that has revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. So I've had a change in heart. We get a change of heart that's deep and effective, right? We could have a vision of God, but if we don't stop eating, we could say that that is not an effective spiritual experience, deep and effective, which has revolutionized, like brought in a big major change about how we look at life towards other people and toward God's world. And it says the central fact of our lives today, not that I stopped binging, this is what it says. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty, like we're 100% sure that our Creator, our loving Creator, has entered into our hearts and lives, or into our hearts and lives, in a way which is indeed miraculous. At its essence, this program is about miracles. It is about the Creator of the universe entering into our individual hearts and lives and doing miracles. And what does he do? Well, the next line says, he has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. I couldn't stop binging by myself. God accomplished that for me. I couldn't stop being a selfish, self-centered person. God accomplished that for me. Not 100% yet. He's still got some work to do with me, but I'm definitely better than I was. God has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Well, how do we get this spiritual experience? Remember our step 12, it's a promise. Having had a spiritual experience, which I believe is how it read in the original, now it's spiritual awakening, same thing. One is just blink of an eye quick. The other is progressive and takes more time. Having had a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Y'all, all we have to do is work these steps and it will automatically happen to us. And they say, if you're a seriously alcoholic, as serious a compulsive eater as we are, there is no middle-of-the-road solution. It's not, I'll work some of these steps some of the time. No middle-of-the-road solution. Well, this is hard to say, no middle-of-the-road solution. But remember, this is for those of us who feel hopeless, for those of us who were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And it says, if we have passed the region from which there is no return, through human aid, we had but two alternatives. No return through human aid. That means no person, no group. Our group cannot be our higher power. You know, someone once asked me, well, if a person doesn't believe in God, can they start with a group as a higher power? I'm saying, well, no, the big book doesn't say we can. It says no return through human aid. And I think about, like, our poor cancer patient. You know, imagine her going to the doctor saying, you've got cancer, and the solution is chemotherapy. And her saying, you know what, I don't like chemo. That's going to be hard. I would rather just take penicillin, take an aspirin. And the doctor says, okay, we'll start you with an aspirin, then move up to penicillin, and then when you're ready, we'll move up to chemotherapy. The doctor would never say that. The doctor says, I'm sorry, that's all I got for you. And if someone says to me, well, I don't believe in God, and as we'll see on a few pages from now, it says, if you're agnostic, it's okay as long as you're willing to believe in God. But I will never give someone pablum. I will never say, fine, make the group or a sunset or a doorknob your higher power. Because that's not a solution. That's not what's going to give us a spiritual experience. So it says, if we're hopeless and we believe there's no return through human aid, we have two choices: to go on to the bitter end, blotting out our intolerable situation, basically staying in the food, or the other, to accept spiritual help. Now notice, it says we get help. We don't have to come in here believing in anything. When I came around, I believed in God, but I had a God who was a genie. God, come out of your bottle and do what I want. Basically, remove my food obsession, make this boy like me, whatever it was, and then go back in your bottle and leave me alone. I treated God like a servant, like a Santa Claus. Here's my wish list. But spiritual help means I let people teach me how to have a proper relationship with God, right? Talks about that in chapter 5. He is the principal. We are his agent. Well, an agent has work that a principal has work that he needs done, and he wants the agent to help him. And what's God's work? He talks about it in There Is a Solution. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's creation, that means I got spiritual help to see that there was a God, that if I surrender my life to him, he will give me a life of purpose, that God is ever advancing creation. That means he didn't just create the world and sit back and watch Netflix for the rest of eternity. He's still creating. He's still recreating. Well, what I personally, and this is my opinion, believe that he is recreating addicts just like us into healthy, productive members of society. But I needed help to do this. I needed help to a proper belief in God. And sometimes people need help believing in any God whatsoever. That's okay. That's why we're here. And then they talk about page 26 and 27, a guy who a friend of mine told me this morning confirmed it was Roland Hazard, who is the first recorded case of an alcoholic recovering by spiritual means. So he went to a psychiatrist for help. He wished above all things to regain self-control. That never works, by the way. We need to be God-controlled. And it said, the doctor told him he was hopeless. And page 27, he's begging the doctor. He says, is there anything I can do? And the doctor says, I've never seen one single case recover. That means there was a 0% recovery rate where the state of mind existed to the extent it did for you, the broken bridge and the physical obsession. And our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. And he asked the doctor, is there an exception? And he said, yes, the only exception for vital spiritual experiences. And the doctor said, to me, these occurrences are phenomena, a phenomena, the definition, something that is extraordinary. And it furthers the definition of a spiritual experience. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. And the doctor says, I've been trying to produce these emotional rearrangements within you, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Well, of course, because it can't be treated on the mind level. It has to be treated on the spiritual level. How do we do it? Prayer, meditation, surrender our lives to God as best we can, clear away the wreckage of our past, then clear away the wreckage of each day, continue to try and seek more God, and continue to help others. We treat it on a spiritual level. So Roland says, well, okay, a spiritual experience may work for me. I'm a good church member. But the doctor said, yeah, your religious convictions, good. They don't spell, they don't equal the necessary vital spiritual experience. I could go to church all I want, go to synagogue, go to mosque, whatever, all I want. And I did while I wasn't rigorously honest. In fact, I was rigorously dishonest, where I didn't clear away the wreckage of my past because I didn't care about other people, where I certainly didn't surrender to God's will. So it says, page 28. Here was a terrible dilemma our friend found himself in when he had the extraordinary experience. Roland Hazard had that spiritual experience, and then he was one of those people who went to the judge to get Ebby, who later went to Bill. Because he had that extraordinary spiritual experience, and then God was able to use him in his mission of recreating lives. And then it says, we in our turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men, right? So it's what seemed at first a flimsy reed. Okay, if I'm drowning and the only thing to grab onto is a flimsy reed, I'll do it, even if I don't believe it'll help me. Because deep in my heart, I will have this prayer, Lindsay Reed, I don't believe you can help me, but please do. So what do we do if we're desperate and we don't believe in God? And I believe we can say a prayer that goes something like this. God, I'm drowning, and I don't know if you exist, but these people are telling me you're my only hope. I don't know if you exist, and if you exist, I don't know if you care about me. But if you do exist and you do care, please help me. And I believe if we say this prayer, then God will turn to his like angels up in the heavens and say, okay, our next search and rescue mission is for her, is for him. That's opinion. That's not fact. But I do believe that prayer sets something in motion, and we can start with an honest prayer of, God, I don't know. And then we follow it up with the things that we think God, if he did exist, would want for us. We know that God would want for us, I mean, our book tells us, we have to be rigorously honest, so not to lie. We have to help other people. We have to try to connect with this God. So I tell my sponsees from day one, spend 30 minutes every morning, prayer, meditation, spiritual reading, trying to connect with God. And not one of them has ever come back to me and said, Janet, that was a total waste of time. Not one. And they say what seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be a loving and powerful hand of God. So there's a couple clues about God. He's loving. He's powerful. And there's more clues about God all throughout this book, but some of my favorite, page 45, when they tell us lack of problem is our dilemma, and they tell us the main problem of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. So if this power is going to solve my problem, it has to be able to think, right? And a hurricane is a power greater than me, but a hurricane can't think and solve problems. This power has to be strong because this illness is stronger than I am. So this power has to be stronger than this illness. This power has to be smart because, you know, I've got two master's degrees and I couldn't figure out how to solve this problem. And finally, this power must care about me. Otherwise, why would this power bother solving my problem? There is a loving, powerful God who cares about us. And they say a new life has been given us, a design for living that really works. And they quote another book, Varieties of Religious Experience, which says it indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. And the authors of our big book say, we have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. But they do want to convince us that faith must be acquired, that it's important. And they are very crystal clear about saying anyone, no matter their race, creed, color, are the children of a living creator, a creator that's still alive, still living, and that's still creating, with whom we may form a relationship, not a creator that's just like sitting up on a cloud watching us. We can have a relationship with our living creator, with our God. And it says the terms are simple and understandable. As soon as we're willing and honest enough to try, when we are willing, we get results. On page 46, it says, we found as soon as we're able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commence to get results. And what are those results? It tells us in the next paragraph, a new sense of power, power over the obsession with food, and direction, as in, what do I need to do? Provided we take other simple steps, provided we continue on in these steps. It says, if you're religious, or even if you're not religious, there's no friction among us. Nothing will go against your religious beliefs. And they tell us, it doesn't matter what religious belief or religious body you identify with, or if you identify with none at all, it's fine. Bottom of page 28, it says, in the following chapter, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it, then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. It says, many who once were in this class are now among our members. Notice it doesn't say many who are still in this class are now among our members. We can start an agnostic, but we can't stay that way because the solution is a relationship with God. And page 29, it says, clear-cut directions. Well, thank God there's clear-cut directions, right? It tells you exactly what to do. Clear-cut directions are given, showing how we recovered, followed by personal stories. And they tell us the point of the stories. Each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God, what all stories should have in common. So the point of the stories isn't just, it is experience, strength, and hope. Well, what's our experience? You know, that we were train wrecks, that we were hot messes. But what gives us our strength and hope? We've got our relationship with God and how God works in our lives. And they end up by saying, we hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts, you know, in bad taste, our hope. So this is what the founders of this program hope, that many alcoholic men and women, many compulsive eater men and women desperately in need, that's the audience. The audience isn't just to lose 10 pounds to look good at her high school reunion so that boy who dumped her, you know, will feel bad. Not that I can relate to any of that. That's not our audience. Our audience is someone desperately in need. We'll see these pages, and by disclosing ourselves, by disclosing what we used to be like, how we got our relationship with God, how we had a spiritual experience, and how that transformed us, that it will persuade other people to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. What is this thing? It's a relationship with God. It's our spiritual experience. So that we're not the same people. And when that happens and we're a different person, it's like the soil of our soul is changed and the illness of compulsive eating just can't live there anymore. We're changed. We're different people. And, you know, I'll just close with like how Dr. Silkworth closed the doctor's opinion. He says, I earnestly advise for every compulsive eater to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. And with that, I will pass. Thank you.
Thanks, Janet. So appreciative. Thank you for a very thorough and informative presentation this morning. And now we're going to transition to a question and answer period. So get ready with some questions for Janet. Before we do that, let me give you the share ID for this morning's presentation. That number is 22,320. That's 22320. And also hang out for the end of the recorded hour. We're going to end at the top of the hour, 9 a.m., excuse me, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get Janet's contact information. So now, if you have a question for Janet, please press star one and give me your first name and last initial. Who has some questions for Janet?
Lisa Joby.
Elena C.
Dara S.
Elena, Dara.
Maureen H.
Maureen.
Maggie.
B.
Maggie and Nadine.
Terry Beth.
Was that Terry?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, got Terry.
Did you get Jeannie B?
I did not. Thanks, Jeannie. Let me put you in there as well. Okay, here's who I heard so far. I think it was Lisa was the first person I heard. I hope I have that right. Elena, Dara, Maureen, Maggie, Nadine, Terry, and Jeannie. Did I miss somebody in that first grouping? Okay, so let's go ahead and mute your lines. If you're not Lisa, please mute. If not Lisa, we're ready for your question for Janet. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Lisa Joby in Denver, Colorado. Janet, thank you so much. My question to you is, what is your morning routine like contacting prayer and meditation and throughout the day? How do you connect with your higher power, God? Thanks.
Hey, Lisa Jo. So in the morning, it's usually close to an hour, and I do a few things. I read something spiritual to just help me learn more about God, usually the Bible, a Bible study, or sometimes I'll read a devotional. I looked up the devotionals that the founders of AA studied, and I got some of those. And then I'll spend time in prayer. So I always start with worship, because otherwise I'm coming to God as like he's Santa Claus with my gimme list. So I worship, I pray for people who I need help, and I pray for situations in the world. And I ask for help for myself, that as I go through the day that I'm free of self-pity, dishonesty, resentment, fear, selfish, self-seeking motives. I ask for God to destroy my pride. And so let's see. Yes, I spend that time in prayer. The night before, my prayer consists of like my nightly review, where I'll look at things I may have done wrong during the day, and I ask him to forgive me. And then I write down at least five gratitudes, and I don't just like write them on my app. I then thank him for them. And so, you know, I've got kind of the repentance or confession, thanksgiving, worship of God, praying for people and for situations, asking for forgiveness for things I've done wrong. And then I conclude with a prayer that God shows me throughout the day what I need and gives me strength to take care of the problems that arise. And I end with a little more worship. And during the day, I just think about him. I mean, I will say, early on, when I wanted to think of like, okay, remember to turn things over to God, I wore my watch upside down. So when I would look at it, I would remember to like turn things over. And so sometimes during the day, if something's hard, I'll just pray. And I also try and remember, and I need to be better at this, to thank him when good things happen during the day. And then also in the morning, so I have prayer, a spiritual reading, and then I meditate. I take my journal and a pen, and I sit and I put on some music, and I just pray, God, I pray for knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry it out. How can I help the still suffering compulsive eater today? And I listen, and if there's a particular problem in my life that I want some direction with, I will ask that too, and then I will sit, and some days I get nothing, and some days I get something, but I give God the time and the space to communicate with me if he wants to. So that's my morning routine. Thanks.
Thanks, Janet.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, thanks, Lisa. Okay, next up we have Elena, followed by Dara. Elena, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Larry. Thank you so much, Janet. My name is Elena C., gratefully recovered compulsive overeater in South Carolina. You have said something very profound, and I wrote it down. You said something that a disease starts in our souls and centers in our minds, and then through recovery, the core of our soul has changed, and the disease cannot stay there anymore. Would you mind saying more about that?
Yeah, so the book says once a spiritual malady has overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So that tells me that my main problem is spiritual, that I have a problem in my soul. So that's where I need to work at my recovery. It's like if I had pneumonia and I just took cough medicine, I may mask a symptom, but the disease would progress. So I need to do actions that heal my soul. I mean, ultimately, God is the one who heals my soul, but I can put myself in a position where I can be healed, and that's what these 12 steps do. They tell us how to put ourselves in a position so that the grace of God can heal us. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Elena. Next up, we have Dara, followed by Maureen. Dara, good morning.
Hi, this is Dara F. calling from Virginia, and I wanted to clarify, Janet, did I hear you correctly? Did you say that you do not believe that a person has to be abstinent first before working the steps? And if so, could you clarify that a little more? Thank you.
Yes. So I will tell you my experience. I was binging right before a meeting, stuffing bagel chips down my throat behind a locked bathroom door. And I went to a meeting and I took a sponsor and I said, you know, I'm desperate. I'll do whatever it takes. And I went out in the parking lot and I just said a prayer. I basically said to God what I said to my sponsor, I will do whatever it takes. And that was the end of my binging. Do I believe that someone should keep working the steps as they're binging? No, because then there's obviously a problem. But what I have found, and there's a beautiful quote I heard once, willingness opens the door to grace. That as soon as a person is willing and starts doing this work, they get power. I mean, on page 46, which is about step two, it talks about we get power as soon as we admit that maybe there's a God. And I believe we get enough power to take us through the next step. So as a sponsor, if I am working with someone who cannot put the food down, then it's my job to sit with them and not give them, you know, just a bunch of work, but to, in 2 hours, we can get someone to step two. Do you see how you're powerless? Do you see how your bridge is broken? Give me some examples. Okay, you see you're powerless. Your life is unmanageable. Are you willing to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore us to sanity? Well, the person says, I have some prejudices. Okay, here's how the book says we get through those prejudices. Are you willing to believe that God can restore you to sanity? And if they say, okay, yes, I'm willing, and then they start doing the work, they start going to meetings, whatever. In my experience, I have found that the person will not keep binging as long as she keeps doing the work. I could sit with someone and she could say, okay, I get it, and go home and be abstinent for a day. But if she doesn't continue on in her steps or she doesn't practice rigorous honesty, she's not going to stay abstinent. So what I'm saying is, I guess what I'm saying is this. Yes, a person needs to be abstinent, but they can only, but it's okay if they're abstinent for 10 minutes. They can start then. Obviously, I'm not going to start working with someone while she's got an ice cream sundae that she's shoveling down her throat. But if she's said, I just binge and I'm done and I'm desperate, I believe I can start working with her then. So I hope that clarifies it.
Thanks, Dara. Okay, next up with a question is Maureen, followed by Maggie. Maureen, good morning.
Hello, this is Maureen from South Carolina. Janet, I just wanted to ask you, can y'all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. What do you think about OA World Service changing steps 3, 7, and 11 instead of the pronoun him? I think they were going to change it to God or HT, or I hope it's not humbly asked it to remove our shortcomings. Wondered what you thought about that.
So I'm not familiar with any talk about changing anything, so I really can't give a good opinion.
Okay. Thanks, Maureen. Next up with a question, Maggie, followed by Nadine. Maggie, good morning.
Yes, hello. This is Maggie A. from Massachusetts. Thank you for your service. I'm wondering, Janet, if you think there is a good checklist, like a quiz, to determine if someone is really a food addict. I think I saw that OA has like a pamphlet. And then the second part of that, could someone have like just a physical allergy without the spiritual problem? I have, I'm talking about myself, actually. I have candida and several food allergies, but volume is not a problem. So I'm really trying to determine if I really, what I really need to recover. So just wondering if you had any thoughts about that. Thanks.
Yeah, so on page 44, it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, or for us eating, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic or compulsive eater. So that's how they talk about it here. To me, that's like the best checklist. Do I think someone could have the physical allergy without the obsession of the mind and the spiritual part? Yes, I do. I think that's how I read the book, but, you know, I might be wrong. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maggie. Okay, next up we have Nadine, followed by Terry. Good morning, Nadine. Nadine, press star one. Okay, we'll come back to Nadine. We'll try again. Terry, do you have a question, followed by Jeannie?
Yeah. Excuse me. This is Terry from Texas,
Good morning.
Dallas. Good morning. So I came in late, Janet, but I wanted to clarify or verify. Did you, or I guess I was hearing that people have to believe in God or have a power greater than, I don't know, maybe limit, do I get to decide if it's for somebody else, if they can't believe in a doorknob or to tell, I didn't quite understand, because I don't even know the title of your talk. What is your belief in people, agnostic and atheist, who continue to remain atheist and not agnostic in the program and work a spiritual, beautiful program, which I have encountered these people. So that's what I wanted to hear your point of view, what to verify, clarify. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. So I did address it, but in a nutshell, I mean, our step three says that we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So a person can start out not believing in God as long as they are willing to. And a doorknob as God, in my opinion, doesn't make sense, because how could a doorknob restore me to sanity. So that's my understanding of this book. Again, wrong, but that's how I understand it. They were pretty clear that it was God as an individual understands him. Your conception certainly doesn't have to be the same as mine, but I don't know. In my opinion, I can't see how a doorknob could restore anyone to sanity. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll try to circle back. Nadine, are you there? Press star one if you are. Okay, perhaps she dropped off. Next up is Jeannie. Jeannie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, everyone, who made this meeting possible. Janet, you kind of answered this, but I really want to make sure I understand this. You said I had what I heard you say is that you wanted this desperately, but you did not have the power. The power was what you were missing. You had the desire. You had the will. Maybe I'm adding in the willingness. You were eating the bagel chips in your car. You had the desire. You went into this meeting, and you got the power because of your willingness. I want to make sure I understand how you went in kind of without the power. And you said something about in one of your answers to the question that you got the power because you were willing. Is something in there? If you could help me just get that point, please.
So a saying I heard once is willingness opens the door to grace. And I became willing. I took a super hard sponsor who I was terrified of because I was just desperate. And our book says, we found page 46, as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commence to get results. And the next paragraph, they tell us the results we get are power, right? That's what I needed, power and direction. So I hope that helps.
Okay. We have time for perhaps two or three more questions. Who else has a question?
Rob H.
Hanayeta. Okay, we're going to stop there. Hanayeta. Leah S. And there was a gentleman in there. Okay. Is there another gentleman as well?
Yeah, there was.
Rob H.
Okay. Yeah. All right, let's start off. We'll see where we get. Hanayeta followed by Leah. Hanayeta, good morning. Just one question, please.
Just one question, promise. Okay, and I'll get right to it besides saying thank you so much, Larry, and thank you, Janet. You said that you thank God for all the gratitude you have. I was wondering if you ever thank God for all the things that you think are bad that happen in your life.
No, I don't sit there and thank him for things that are bad. I do sometimes, say, like, God, for instance, I've had a health issue recently, and I'm like, God, please remove this, if it be thy will, but if you intend to do something good, if this is for your glory or my good for this problem to continue, then don't remove it. But no, I don't sit there and actively, like, thank him for bad things.
Thank you.
Okay, next up with the question is Leah, followed by Pete. Leah, good morning.
Thank you very much. I wonder if you heard of the term a two-way prayer, and I wonder how you can explain you do that. Thank you.
Yeah, so two-way prayer is a system of prayer that I do sometimes, and it's where we ask God a question, and then we write a letter back to ourselves. So mine start like, dear Janet, beloved daughter of mine. And I write the way that I think God would write if he were writing back to me. And that's what two-way prayer is. And I use it sometimes. There's some people who use it all the time. There's some people who use it never. So thanks.
Okay, and we got Pete followed by Rob, if we have time. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking the meeting. Janet, thank you for your presentation. It was deep and heavy. When you started your journey to recovery, did you have a desired outcome, and has your desired outcome changed since you started?
That's a good question. So my only desired outcome when I started was to stop binging, right? I didn't come here because I wanted to be a better person. I didn't care about that. I just wanted to stop binging and throwing up. And so that has happened, thank God. And I would say my desire now, honestly, it's, well, obviously to stay that way. But what I think about is, truly, my desire is to help more people and get closer to God and bring Him glory. If you were to ask me today, what are my desires? I would say those three things: help more people, grow closer to God myself, and bring Him glory. Thank you for asking that so that I could articulate that to myself.
Thanks, Pete. Okay, let's close it up with a question from Rob. Good morning, Rob.
Thank you. I had a question about mental obsession. I was thinking, what maybe you could say, is there, what in your mind would be the opposite of like a mental obsession for in relation to this disease?
Peace, serenity, neutrality. I think those are the words that come to mind. And I think the way to fight that mental obsession, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know if this is true, that you can't hold more than one thought in your mind at a time, is to use my mind to obsessively focus on God and how I can be of service to other people. If I'm thinking about that and then doing it, like, okay, let me go, you know, my grandmother who I haven't visited in a year, let me go visit her and spend the afternoon with her and talk about whatever she wants to. Let me spend more time in prayer. I think those are, and then obviously working the steps, those are the ways that the mental obsession gets quieted until by the end of step 9, it's gone.
Thanks so much. And Janet, thanks again. So appreciative of your gracious use of time this morning. You helped us all. And I'm going to give the share ID number again for Janet's presentation this morning. That number, 22,320. That's 22320. And hang on, because we will, at the end of the recorded period of time, we will ask Janet for her contact information. So if you got more questions for her, you can reach out to her. But I'm going to close now with a reading from page 1. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.